Daily Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 4th, and here are some of the stories we're covering. Despite its best efforts to clear the country of explosives, Libya is still counting the cost of war on this International Day of Mine Awareness.
Larger number of unexploded ordnance due to the indiscriminate fighting between armed groups have resulted in large areas being inaccessible to civilians.
South Sudan ministers complain about what they say is U.S. intervention in their country. Rights groups criticize Zambia's criminal defamation law. Eswatini University lecturers vow to continue their strike for pay equity. Policy analysts say structural inequities hamper efforts to improve infrastructure development in Africa.
The second target is 50% of our programming will place local actors in the lead within the decade. That's 7 years from now.
A Human Rights Watch says Tanzania's government has cut off health services in the Ngorongoro district. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. This International Day of Mine Awareness today, Tuesday, civilians in Libya are still suffering from the effects of landmines and other explosives, despite the efforts of multiple agencies to clear the country of the weapons. Reporter Alicia Folkman has more from Tunis.
Libya's last major civil war may have ended in May 2020, but across Tripoli there are still no-go zones littered with uncleared landmines and other explosive ordnances. According to the United Nations Mine Action Service, UNMAS, despite multiple agencies working to clear the explosive remnants of war across Libya, the remnants have caused some 182 accidents and 369 casualties. According to Hannah Salah, Human Rights Watch's Associate Director for Middle East and North Africa, the remnants of war date back to World War II, but the worst contamination was seen in the country's most recent conflict, when Field Marshal Khalifa Haftar's Libyan National Army pushed west into Tripoli in 2019.
More recently, in 2019, have resulted in a large-scale contamination concentrated in the southern suburbs of Tripoli. Very large numbers of banned anti-personnel landmines that are internationally banned, but also an even larger number of unexploded ordnance due to the indiscriminate fighting between armed groups have resulted in large areas being inaccessible to civilians. But civilians are also affected in a way that they are unable to resume their daily lives. They're unable to send their children to school because some of the schools have been damaged or have been contaminated. Their own homes are inaccessible to them.
Salah says that the fighting destroyed huge amounts of infrastructure, including electric power lines, roads, and medical clinics. But in the agricultural land south of Tripoli, farmers can no longer cultivate their land for fear of landmines. Dr. Shukri Al-Shukri is a trauma and orthopedic surgeon based in Tripoli who has treated many victims of landmines during and after the war. He says that although not on the massive scale of wartime, he still sees victims who have stepped on explosive devices and other deadly remnants of war. He says the impact of the injuries is both tragic and life-changing.
We received a lot of patients related to this type of injury during the last war. One case that I can't forget is a young guy who arrived at our clinic in a miserable condition that made us amputate both his lower limbs above the knee. The patient went through a long recovery journey involving carrying out other wounds, managing weight loss, and accommodating the use of the artificial implanted limbs. In addition to losing limbs, patients suffer from stopping going to work and in some cases losing their jobs. They also suffer from losing their loved ones as they are unable to maintain their relationships due to their condition. For example, in one case I treated, the patient's parents kept visiting him in the hospital at first, but then left him back to live her life away from him.
Hanan Salah stresses the need for the government in Tripoli and the eastern Libyan authorities to work with landmine clearing and humanitarian agencies to prioritize clearing and risk education to ensure that people are not injured or killed.
Human Rights Watch feels strongly that Libya should accede to the mine ban treaty and should also commit to a comprehensive prohibition of the use of anti-personnel landmines, which unfortunately we saw were being used still to a great extent in the last conflict.
Human rights activists say in Libya, as with many former conflict zones, peace is not enough to end the impact of war, but that continued efforts to clear landmines will allow Libyans to travel throughout their country without fear of injury or death. For Voice of America Africa, I'm Elysia Folkman in Tunis.
Some South Sudanese government officials said the Biden administration is interfering in the country's affairs. The acting Minister of Foreign Affairs and International Cooperation, Deng Dao, made the comments after the U.S. extended national emergency for South Sudan beyond 2023. For VOA News, Juliana Siapai reports from Juba.
On April 3rd, 2014, former U.S. President Barack Obama issued executive order declaring a national emergency to deal with unusual extraordinary threat to the national security and foreign policy of the United States due to the situation in South Sudan. Last month, the Biden administration extended the national emergency beyond 2023, citing threats to peace, security, or stability of South Sudan and the surrounding region. Speaking at the joint press conference over the weekend in Juba, the acting Minister of Foreign Affairs and International Cooperation, Deng Dao, says the situation in South Sudan has improved and the United States should stop the continuation of the national emergency for South Sudan.
Some of our friends, foreign friends, have continued to play the role of doubting Thomases by occasionally dampening our spirit through unhelpful actions such as renewal of sanctions, an arms embargo, and justified condemnation at the Human Rights Council, and just yesterday, March 29, through the renewal of what the United States government called notice on the continuation of the national emergency with respect to South Sudan.
The notice of the continuation of national emergency of South Sudan mentioned widespread violence and atrocities, human rights abuses, recruitments and use of child soldiers, attacks on peacekeepers, and obstruction of humanitarian operation in South Sudan. South Sudan's Minister of Information, Communication and Postal Services, Michael McQuay-Lueth, says the government of South Sudan is discouraged by the actions of the Biden administration. McQuay says the government of South Sudan will continue to implement the 2018 Revitalized Peace Agreement.
The roadmap, as it is now, is in progress. The roadmap was operational from the 23rd of February. That is about 1 month and something now, and a week. But there are those who are becoming impatient and saying the roadmap is not progressing. It is not being implemented. I don't know how do they read the roadmap. We are implementing the roadmap and progressing very well.
Last week, the Troika countries of the UK, Norway and the United States issued a statement calling on South Sudanese leaders to complete some key provisions in the 2018 peace deal. Albina Akol Attak-Mayom is the Minister of Humanitarian Affairs and Disaster Management, says the government will provide protection to humanitarian aid workers across the country.
Because of this crisis that we are in, as the government of South Sudan and people of South Sudan, plus natural disasters, our people are hungry and indicators are too huge. This is why the government is putting all the efforts so that these things are addressed. And we always welcome our partners to help us in this.
The three senior South Sudanese government officials say the implementation of Revitalized Peace Agreement is on track despite several challenges like sanctions and arms embargo imposed on the country in 2018 by the UN Security Council. For VOA News, I am Juliana Shiapai in Juba.
In Zambia, the Chapter 1 Foundation says the fundamental rights of citizens charged with criminal defamation of the president are being violated. This after the government repealed the law last year. Critics say the previous governments routinely used the law to target opponents. Linda Katsonde is the executive director of the Chapter 1 Foundation. She tells viewers Peter Clotty that continuing support is needed to uphold and promote the values of freedom of expression and opinion as enshrined in the Constitution.
The president repealed the crime of defamation of the president, which was now penal code. However, the repealing of that act did not have retrospective effect. So anybody who was charged before the repeal of the act can still go through the whole prosecution and trial. So we propose that the Director of Public Prosecution, who has the discretion as to whether or not to prosecute matters, should exercise his discretion not to prosecute such matters in the spirit of the reason why the defamation of the president's law was repealed. Now, we still have on our statute books the crime of ordinary defamation. So there is civil defamation and there's also criminal defamation, which applies to everybody else who's not the president.
Does your organization believe that the case against independent parliamentarian Muniru Zulu should not be carried out based on the call?
I think we need to make it clear that our organization, Chapter One Foundation, is not encouraging spurious claims against individuals or anything of that nature. We feel that if that case could arise in the civil court, are the appropriate venue for dealing with such disputes. For the reasons mentioned earlier, that when you start criminalizing speech, it can be weaponized against every ordinary citizen, not just people who perhaps a bit mischievous. So that's really what we're saying, that one shouldn't look at individual cases, but look at the whole scheme of things and how such laws can be weaponized against ordinary citizens. So it's better that such laws don't exist and that people use rather the civil avenue to resolve such disputes.
Well, Linda, what do you say to those who are of the view that if it's repealed, people will get away with defaming people, casting aspersion at people, and basically making people unpopular just for political gains?
I think it's worth mentioning that the criminal defamation laws have largely been used with regarding sort of political claims, you know, matters relating to politics. And so by decriminalizing that, you still have the avenue of resolving the dispute through civil litigation. And as I say, it's mostly politicians who find themselves laying charges or the state leading charges on their behalf. As public figures, there's a certain amount of criticism that you should be able to take. And if indeed it's injurious to your reputation, then, as I mentioned, the avenue is to go to the civil court.
What's next for your organization in the call for these laws to be repealed and for DPP, for the DPP to use his or her discretion not to go after people who were charged before the law was repealed?
Well, the agenda of our organization for the next coming couple of years is to ensure that we have law reform and constitutional reform that leads to a more conducive environment for all people in Zambia to participate freely in the governance of our country.
Linda Kasonde is the executive director of the Chapter One Foundation of Zambia. She spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 4. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Lecturers at the University of Eswatini, formerly Swaziland, say their strike, which began March 8, will continue until their demands are met. Meanwhile, classes are being suspended. The country's principal secretary for education did not respond to our message. Sibusiso Rambasi is the chairperson of the Association of Lecturers, Academic and Administrative Personnel at the University of Swaziland. He tells me the strike is about pay inequity at the university. He says workers are paid less while board members are paid more than required by law.
Basically, the strike action is about a dispute the staff has with the management of the university. It is mainly a simple dispute on movements within pay grades. You know, there's this notion that when you are employed somewhere, you have to move within the pay grades until you reach the ceiling. So the lecturers at the university has not been able to move. The last time they moved within their pay grade was 2018. They have not moved since then. So because of the current prevailing economic meltdown, the lecturers have found themselves with the purchasing power having been drastically reduced. So they've lost a lot of purchasing power and they are unable to make ends meet. And they can't provide their families and themselves simple basic needs. Hence, they then requested management to reconsider this issue of movement within pay grades and management reduced, which has then resulted to the current strike action.
Exactly. So that's what I wanted to ask, because if your strike began March 8, have you made any representation with either the government or the university administration?
Yes, we, as an association, we have what we call a recognition agreement with the university. Actually, we can't even go to strike without engaging them. We engage them and we reach the deadlock, because we have what we call a joint negotiation committee, which is a committee of ourselves and management, where we sit and discuss issues that touches on the welfare of the staff members. So this strike actually is as a result of those talks having failed. And then the management has come to negotiate with us. I think they've met us three times, but they are still not coming up with a proper offer that can be acceptable to our members.
What kind of offer do you think will be acceptable to your members?
It's difficult to say how much in monetary form we are demanding. But what we are saying is that there are five pay grades within the university. So our argument is that if a person is supposed to be in grade 5, just place them there. Those who are supposed to be in grade 4, in grade 3, in grade 2, in grade 1. So what we're saying is that the people should move, because if people have not moved within the pay grade for the past 5 years, it means that perhaps someone will have been at grade 4 by now, but is still stuck at grade 1. So what we are saying is that move the person to the proper category that he or she is supposed to be. But the management is refusing to do that. They are citing the lack of funding from government, that they are not able to fund this because it will have an effect on the wage bill. So basically, that's where we are not finding each other.
Is learning going on during the strike? I mean, are you teaching during the strike?
There is no learning that is going on, and there's not going to be any learning that will take place until the strike action is over.
Sibuseso Mbatsi is the chairperson of the Association of Lecturers, Academic and Administrative Personnel at the University of Swaziland. He was speaking with us from the capital, Mbabane. Policy analysts say structural inequities continue to hamper efforts by non-profit actors in Africa to improve infrastructure development on the continent. VOA's Initials are now reports from Washington.
African countries are among the leading recipients of foreign development aid, and aid policy analysts say it is important to increasingly localize aid programs. Chinwe Efion is Chief Program Officer at Global Giving. She says, for instance, a United States Agency for International Development Program, the negotiated Indirect Cost Rate Agreement, or NICRA, undercuts African non-governmental organizations.
The NICRA is a negotiated interest rate, which is the overhead that nonprofits need to run their business. So most international NGOs can claim a NICRA of up to 40% to pay their salaries, to pay the rents, and, you know, all the operational costs. African NGOs in particular are capped at 10%. Even though in most situations they're doing 90% of the work. So right there is a glaring inequity that is staring us right in the face but not being addressed.
A recent Washington forum brought together aid experts to address some of the key challenges bedeviling the continent of 1.4 billion people. USAID says it has begun reforms to address the issues raised. Mouyaldin Omar is USAID's Africa Bureau Senior Advisor. He told VOA that by 2025, its first goal is to provide 25% of its budget directly to local nonprofits in Africa, compared with the current 7%.
The second target is 50% of our programming will place local actors in the lead within the decade. That's 7 years from now. So that's the goal, and that would require doing two things. One, reforming the agency in itself, to be able to directly work with local actors to not only observe this funds that we're talking about, 25%, but also to do the work in a very meaningful way that would impact these local communities.
As some African leaders look for an equal Western partnership, is foreign aid still the future for the continent? Fiwakule Ngwando is a professor of African studies at Howard University in Washington.
You come from certain countries that are quite poor in the African on the African continent. Yes, it is. So there is still a need. We would be lying to ourselves if we said there's not a need for aid. However, we are unlearning some things. We're learning basically that there is an Africa that no longer needs aid, but needs partnerships, needs business opportunity. And they, even as there is still an Africa that needs all the aid it can get.
James Winkler is the vice president of Creative Associates International.
We need to program foreign aid differently. There are times when humanitarian assistance because of starvation or disasters or a pandemic requires assistance to help our African brothers and sisters that need immediate help and they can't do it by themselves.
Foreign participants included students, academics and professionals who made a case that the socio-cultural and economic interests of African countries should be considered when foreign partners initiate development programs. Ignatius Anor, VOA News, Washington.
Human Rights Watch says the Tanzanian government has cut off health services in the Ngorongoro district as part of what it terms as voluntary resettlement plan for local residents in order to preserve wildlife in the Ngorongoro conservation area. The International Human Rights Group's Deputy Washington Director, Nicole Waldschreim, tells viewers Caravan Dam the move has hurt the Maasai community's ability to access health services in the area.
The Maasai are a semi-nomadic pastoral community. They've lived in that and managed living amongst vital and endangered wildlife for over 200 years in the Ngorongoro Crater and District. So this is not a voluntary resettlement plan for these residents. They are being denied right to health and access to basic services and thus being forced out of their home area. They're being forced to an area that's 600 kilometers away from where they have lived for over 200 years.
Well, the government said this was done in the name of conservation, but HRW has questioned that reasoning. Did Vice President Kamala Harris bring up the plight of these residents during her talks, do you know, with the leaders in Tanzania?
We aren't sure if she did. We hoped she would. We made a public call after our research was done on the situation there and what's being done to the Maasai community in Tanzania. We made a specific public call asking for Vice President Harris to center human rights and issues specifically like this in the U.S.-Tanzania relationship and in her meetings. We specifically urged her to urge the Tanzanian officials to end the abusive policies in the Ngorongoro district and to preserve the Maasai's community's right to health. We think it can be done while also pursuing a pro-climate and pro-conservationist agenda. This community has lived amongst this environment for years, over 200 years, and has even participated in helping protect the environment.
Just give me your assessment overall of Vice President Harris's trip to Africa. Do you think it was a successful one?
So time will tell. The Biden administration has made a full court press this year after their Africa Leaders Summit in December of last year, promising high-level visits, which they are delivering on. I saw a colleague of mine talk about pageantry over policy. So while this catches the headlines, and it's really good to see Africa and different African communities and cultures spotlighted in her visit and other senior U.S. high-level officials' visits, we got to see the impact that this makes on policy. And this particular issue right now in Tanzania is a perfect example for us to watch.
That was Nicole Waldschreim, Deputy Washington Director for Human Rights Watch. She was speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam. And that's it for this Tuesday, April 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your morning with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Butte in Washington.